Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Jose Mourinho divides opinion. He's won European titles, multiple Premier Leagues, Primera Liga, Scudetto, and a La Liga in an honours list that boasts 19 major trophies in as many years in management. But his self-confidence, temperament, and philosophy have brought detractors. It's nearly a decade since he won the Champions League and 5 years since he won the league, bringing questions over whether the 57-year-old is now a manager past his prime. He's one of only five managers to have won the European Cup with two different teams, and could yet do something unprecedented and win it with a third. Despite coaching last season's Champions League runners-up, a victory with Tottenham would be on par with the level of shock that wins with Porto and Inter were. The question of whether he can do it forms the basis of the cover feature in the new issue of 442, on sale now. I'm Connor Pope, and for today's episode I'll be talking to Chris Flanagan, author of the feature, about how the Champions League made Mourinho, and Seb Stafford-Bloor, a regular 442 contributor, about his impact at Spurs so far. Chris, you've written this month's cover feature on Tottenham manager Jose Mourinho and his search for a third Champions League trophy. It's a feat that's only previously been managed by Bob Paisley, Carlo Ancelotti and Zinedine Zidane, and never with three different clubs. What made you choose this subject for the feature?
With this month being the return of the Champions League, the start of the knockout stages, we wanted to do a fair amount of Champions League coverage in this issue and make it themed in that way. And obviously there's a story around Mourinho coming back to the Premier League with Spurs recently. And it was interesting kind of telling the story of his career and looking at where is Jose Mourinho now? And I think the best way to do that, I felt, was via the Champions League. Given the fact that they've got the Leipzig game coming up in the last 16, and I think really the Champions League does tell his story very well, in that there's a definite arc now. He became a manager exactly 20 years ago. The first 10 years was pretty much all highs. Obviously, winning the Champions League with Porto, then having success with Chelsea. Okay, they didn't quite win it, but they'd certainly done. He took them to a level where they were seen as being one of the very best teams in Europe.
Yeah.
And then obviously won it at Inter. And then from that was 10 years ago. And from that point on, it's obviously gone in a different direction for him, and quite starkly in a different direction. And it was kind of looking at how that's happened and where that's got him to today. Can he still go on and win that third Champions League as everyone expected, or are those days gone from now? Where is Jose Mourinho?
So you've told the story of Mourinho's entire career basically by focusing on six Champions League fixtures, one from each spell at a club that he's managed in the Champions League. Can you tell us a bit about that? Is he a manager that more than most relies on those big game fixtures, do you think?
I think they certainly define him, maybe more than a lot of other managers. The fixtures have been... The first one was sort of an obvious one to choose, really, was the Porto against Manchester United game in 2004, when he obviously ran down the touchline after Porto scored the winner in the last few minutes. And that, obviously, for people in England, that was when he really came to everyone's consciousness, I think.
Obviously, a lot of people would have been aware from him from the UEFA Cup final the year before against Celtic, and there was already a lot of tension between him and Martin O'Neill there. He'd already kind of introduced himself as a real character at that point.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, the running down the touchline, I think, really was is an iconic Champions League moment.
Absolutely.
It?
I mean, I think it was the moment where everyone thought, who's this guy? Yeah. How has he got the cojones to say to do that at Old Trafford, you know, against Alex Ferguson? People just didn't do that. And he not only did that, obviously then went on to win the trophy that season. It kind of straight away, he'd put his name out there as, you know, one of the most legendary bosses of the modern era, really.
And so you've interviewed a few people from throughout his career. What did people have to say about the Man United game and how his approach to it beforehand was?
Well, yeah, I mean, we spoke to Vito Baier and Carlos Alberto, two of the players from that Porto team. And it was interesting that Vito Baier was saying that he remembered when the draw happened in the December beforehand, and all the squad were sat around the TV watching it, and they drew Man United, and most of the players were thinking, well, that's tricky. But Mourinho kind of got up and like punched the air or something, and it was like, the players were like, oh, that's surprising. But, okay, well, if he believes we can beat them, then fine, we'll... Maybe we can beat them.
I think the term, the phrase that's used was that he was relishing a proper rival,
which is
fascinating. And I think brings us well onto the second game you chose, which was Chelsea versus Barcelona in 2005. Yeah. And obviously, talking about rivalries, his rivalry with Barcelona throughout his career has been a fascinating facet of it, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And obviously he worked for Barcelona as an assistant. I think he always thought that one day he would manage them. And obviously that's never happened, and probably won't happen for him. Well, pretty certainly won't happen, given what's happened over the years since then. That Chelsea Barcelona game was an interesting one. That yes, Chelsea had reached the semi-finals the year before that under Ranieri, but they hadn't really faced a top European rival. They'd beaten Arsenal, but obviously that's a domestic rival in the quarterfinals. But they hadn't really. They hadn't beaten a top European team.
Yeah.
And that was the first time when Chelsea really established themselves as, yes, they are one of the best teams in Europe. And in fact, I spoke to Glenn Johnson for this, and he felt that actually that season they were the best team in Europe and proved that by beating Barcelona. It was such an interesting tie in that, like with Manchester United, where he played mind games with Ferguson after the first leg the year before, he played major mind games with Barcelona, with Rijkaard, in that he made a point of, in the press conference before the first leg at Camp Nou, of announcing Barcelona's team, getting that spot on, and then announcing Chelsea's team and deliberately getting it wrong. And I spoke to Damien Duff about it previously, and he said that Jose had said to him, look, I'm going to go and do this press conference, because Duff had a bit of an injury doubt. He was an injury doubt for the game. I'm going to go and do this press conference. I'm going to announce a team. You're not going to be in it, but don't worry, you're playing.
Amazing.
So he knows this team, he knows Good Johnson instead of Duff. And actually, Damien Duff said to me, well, he was so convincing, I sort of wondered, am I actually playing?
But if that was Mourinho's mind games at his absolute best, this fixture also had him at his worst, really, didn't it? Because the Anders Frisk and Frank Rijkaard comments afterwards, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there was the incident at half time in that game where Chelsea lost the game 2-1, but with 10 men, so actually it was a pretty decent result. But there's obviously, Mourinho was very unhappy with the referee, and he claimed that he saw Rijkaard speaking to the referee Anders Frisk at half-time. Now, his version of the events was certainly very disputed and caused a huge furore. Anders Frisk got death threats from people about it. He announced his retirement pretty much immediately. UEFA were furious, Rijkaard was furious. And it just caused a massive furore. And then that led to the second leg. 20 minutes in, Barcelona are losing 3-0. Now, obviously, a lot of that was about Chelsea's tactics, but also you just got to think, well, probably got into Barcelona's heads quite significantly with that. And that was, in those days when Mourinho was having to make a name for himself, his teams were having to make a name for himself, that was a way of doing it, was to get into their heads psychologically. He had good players as well, but he used both things together.
And that psychological element really came into the third game you've chosen here, Inter versus Barcelona in 2010. Obviously, again, it's Barcelona, but it's also the kind of start of that Mourinho-Guardiola rivalry, which obviously has been a dominant force for most of the 2010s. So tell us a little bit about why you chose this game. I'm sure it'll be one that lots of people are familiar with already.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, that in terms of a match, you know, even considering there wasn't an English club involved in it, for me, that was one of the most memorable matches in Champions League history, that second leg, in that it was just the most remarkable back-to-the-wall performance. They had 10 men for an hour. They were playing Barcelona away. And you think, well, they've got no chance at that point. But Mourinho just drilled them so well. And it, for him, I think it was, like you say, it was personal at that point, because after Chelsea had beaten Barcelona, after he then left Chelsea, the Barcelona job came up when Rijkaard left. He felt that he should have got that job. He spoke to Barcelona, had a lot of conversation with them, and I think he felt confident he was going to get it. And obviously they chose Pep Guardiola, the B team boss, and he told them, I think you've made a mistake there. I don't think Guardiola's ready for this job. Now, obviously, that statement doesn't seem quite right these days.
Yeah, no.
But it was personal. He felt he should have got that job. Yeah. So when there's a semi-final, obviously he wants to win the Champions League anyway, but when it's against Barcelona, he really wanted to win that game.
And he felt, I think as well, didn't he, that, or certainly they didn't give him the job because they didn't feel he was enough playing in that Barcelona way, this kind of idea of space and passing and attacking football that had been put forward by Johan Cruyff. So when it comes to this game, he no longer wants to be seen to play anything like the Barcelona way as a way of showing that it's wrong.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. The first leg was an interesting one as well, in that I've seen kind of him talking through it tactically and stuff. It's fascinating in terms of how he managed it and how he knew that Inter could not take on Barcelona at their own game in that. And they were helped in that it was the ash cloud from the volcano.
The biggest tragedy, of course, of that ash cloud being Robert Lewandowski's inability to sign for Sam Allardyce's Blackburn Rovers at the time.
Yes.
But please do carry on.
So that meant Barcelona had to travel to Milan by coach, which obviously not ideal preparation. But still, Mourinho's tactical plan in that game was just perfect. He knew that, like I say, they had to play differently. I think the quote he used, I think, at that time was, well, if the opposition have a Ferrari and I have some small car, I have to puncture their tyres and put sugar in their petrol tank. So that's probably said it all. And he said, basically, they created sort of like word Gabbia, is like a jail for Messi in it. Every player that played in an area where Messi could arrive on that pitch knew that as soon as he was in that area, they had to be on him. And then he drilled into the players that the way we're going to beat Barcelona is transitions. As soon as we get that ball, we attack like lightning with 5-6 players. And that's what they did. They won 3-1. That obviously then allowed them to go to Camp Nou and defend if they needed to. And obviously they needed to.
I just quickly on this, because it was a conversation that we'd had a little bit in the office. Do you think that, I'd always thought that Porto, winning the Champions League with Porto, was really the pinnacle of his career in terms of what an incredible achievement it was. But someone else in the office was making the point that actually winning it with Inter, he had a much tougher run of fixtures. He had to beat Bayern in the final. He had to beat Barcelona before that. Whereas Porto had that Manchester United game, but otherwise they only had to beat Lyon and Monaco on the way to victory. So actually, are these two achievements more comparable than perhaps the way we think?
Well, it's interesting that Mourinho himself has actually said that his biggest achievement was winning it with Inter rather than winning it with Porto, which, like you say, would seem surprising given that Porto, the Porto team he took over, were so far from winning the Champions League. And Inter hadn't won it for a long time, but they're at least seen as an established elite level club at that point. I think they beat Chelsea. He went back to Chelsea in the last 16. CSKA Moscow maybe wasn't too bad, but that semi-final against Barcelona and then Bayern Munich. Yeah, so it's a very, very difficult run. And people did not expect Inter to win that title because, that was an aging Inter team. Okay, they'd won some Serie A titles before that. But I think he spoke about, he felt there was a psychological wall with Inter in the Champions League that they couldn't get past this last 16, the last other quarterfinals, even when they were winning the league every year.
Yeah.
So they had to break that. And then once they broke that season, they went on to win it. And it was interesting that we spoke to Lucio and he was saying that he arrived that season and Mourinho liked him, but one thing he didn't like was that he used to kind of dribble forward, which he always used to do when he was at Leverkusen with Brazil. And Mourinho basically told him, stop doing that. and he said, you know, he said, I'm so grateful that Mourinho told me that because I got into the FIFA Team of the Year that year. I played brilliantly. And he turned him into a pure defender. And that was so evident that night at Camp Nou when him and Walter Samuel at centre-back were just brilliant. I mean, that, like I say, as one of the best defensive performances, and from two centre-backs, that's one of the best ones I've ever seen.
Yeah. So the next game is fast forward to 2013 now. It's Real Madrid versus Borussia Dortmund. This is the first tie that you've picked that Jose Mourinho lost in the Champions League. But it's also the introduction of Jurgen Klopp. Did you pick this tie partly because Klopp, even at that time, was part of the same wave, perhaps, of Pep Guardiola, of a new philosophy around football?
Well, pick that game for two reasons, really. One, it was interesting to kind of read about what Florentino Perez said before that game, where he basically said, well, because Mourinho had some issues with the dressing room, and that was well known by that point.
Yeah.
That, you know, some of the players weren't entirely happy with him. And Perez had said, well, look, it's not easy managing a team of superstars like Real Madrid. But, you know, Dortmund, we know they're a team of children managed by a child's coach. It's a lot easier. Which, when you consider that child's coach was Jurgen Klopp, seems a bit of a daft thing to say with hindsight.
he has a bit of a childish demeanour about
him. I sort of know where he's coming from in that it was a young team and there's a different way of managing it, but he's still rather not very complimentary of Klopp. But the second reason we chose it, that game, was basically that was the end of him at Real Madrid. That was the first time in his career, other than maybe Benfica at the very start, well, that was a situation over a contract between him and the chairman, where he left a club and did not achieve the one thing that he went there to achieve.
Right.
At Porto, he won the Champions League. Obviously, Chelsea won the league. At Inter, he won the Champions League. At Real Madrid, Real Madrid brought him in to win the Champions League, being no doubt about that. They hadn't won it for a long time. They were searching for La Decima. In fact, Perez brought him in because he was so delighted and relieved that Inter had beaten Barcelona and stopped Barcelona going to win Champions League at the Bernabeu, which was their worst nightmare.
Yeah.
So they pretty much did the deal as soon as that semi-final happened. The focus was he was to go there and win the Champions League. Now, they got to the semi-final in all his three seasons there. They won the league in his second season. Then it unravelled in the league in the third season. And then that Dortmund semi-final was the end, basically. As soon as that semi-final went wrong, Lewandowski obviously scored four goals that night. That was the end. And in fact, I think he said after one of the two legs in that, that he sort of started making hints after that game that he quite fancied going back to Chelsea. He didn't say it explicitly, but it was pretty clear from what he was saying that was what he meant.
So the next tie that you've chosen is with Chelsea, but actually going back to Madrid. Mm. It's the game against Atletico Madrid in 2014. Again, this is him going out of the Champions League. What I kind of had forgotten about this was that the second leg came 3 days after that incredible Liverpool-Chelsea game with the famous Steven Gerrard slip, where Chelsea won and ended Liverpool's title hopes, which I think in the middle of all of this is a fascinating little bit of colour. But why this fixture?
2014 is actually the last time that Jose Mourinho won a knockout tie in the Champions League, which is incredible to think, really.
Wow,
six years ago now. They've beaten PSG in the quarterfinals. That's still his last knockout win. Then they go to the semi-finals. It's his first season at Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like, okay, bear in mind, his first spell at Chelsea did everything apart from win the Champions League. Then when he wasn't there, they won the Champions League. Suddenly he kind of thinks, I need to win the Champions League at Chelsea now, because if Di Matteo could do it, I need to do it as well. But obviously in that semi-final, again, it unravelled. They drew 0-0 away. Mourinho was happy with that. And then the second leg, it was all going fine. They were 1-0 up. And then Hazard gets caught out at the back post from a cross. He gets caught napping. Juan Fran runs in behind him, sets up the goal, the away goal, and Atletico go on to win 3-1. And then in the press conference after that game, Mourinho pretty much throws Hazard under the bus and says, you know, he's not ready to sacrifice himself for the team to go that extra yard to defend for his team. Now, okay, Chelsea won the league the year after that and Hazard played well. But that was a telling moment as well in his overall time at Chelsea, in that when things started going wrong again, the criticism of Hazard came back. His relationship with Hazard deteriorated. And then it caused all sorts of problems in the dressing room. As Ramirez, we speak to Ramirez in this, and he basically says that, well, naturally, in a dressing room, you've got players who are unhappy that they're not playing. When someone like Hazard, who's a star player, is also unhappy with a manager, and those people start talking to each other, that snowballs, and that's what happened at Chelsea, and Mourinho never recovered.
I was going to say, Hazard must have been quite a young player at the time, and it's not really a case of, God, Eden Hazard, whatever became of him, is it? So that brings us on to the last game that you've chosen here. Manchester United versus Sevilla in 2018. It was an embarrassing knockout for United, wasn't it? And it was what felt like a very winnable tie.
Yeah.
Did this possibly sum up, you know, Mourinho's time? Was it the beginning of the end, really, for him at United?
Yes, I think so. Even though they finished second in the league that year, that moment was the moment where it started going pretty wrong. I think. I mean, they just signed Alexis Sanchez, and that had unsettled Paul Pogba a bit. And there was already by that February, there was issues between Mourinho and Pogba. Interestingly, Mourinho opted not to start with Pogba for either of those two legs, which is a big statement, really. In what's effectively could be seen as your biggest games of the season, he was on the bench for both games.
Yeah.
They drew 0-0 away. Again, Mourinho was happy with that. Fans were less happy with that, I guess, because people thought, well, this is Sevilla. Why haven't we gone there and attacked them?
Yeah.
We're better than them. And they basically showed very little intent to go and attack at all. And then once that happens, like with Chelsea against Atletico, if you draw 0-0 away, if you concede that away goal at home, you're in trouble. And that's what happened. Basically, second leg, they just, for whatever reason, it didn't turn up. It was a very flat performance. You could tell that something just wasn't quite right. And obviously that manifested itself over the next few months leading to his departure. And what was interesting was that, you know, at a moment when obviously United fans were very upset about losing to Sevilla, he chose to then have a press conference two or three days after that, going on about, you know, football heritage and how United hadn't done anything in the Champions League for years. And okay, what he was saying was factually correct, but it's probably wasn't the right moment to say that in terms of his relationship with United fans, and it didn't go down well, and things started to unravel at United. And it's interesting that, you know, we speak about relationships between the players, and obviously Martial was another one where relationship probably wasn't the best. When Chelsea beat Barcelona back in 2005, there's an interesting quote from Desmond Morris, who's a human behaviour expert, who just happened to, I don't know why he was asked about it at the time, but there's a quote out there basically saying, because Mourinho jumped on John Terry's back when at the final whistle to celebrate Chelsea beating Barcelona. He said, well, to me, that shows that he's not a father figure to the player. He's actually like an elder brother. And I guess the problem with that is that when you're now 57, can you be that elder brother to the players? The age gap is so much bigger. You can be a father figure to players, like Desmond Morris was saying, like Wenger or Ferguson. That can go on for years and years longer. Can you be an elder brother to players now? Can you relate to them in quite the same way? And is that part of the reason why his relationships with some players aren't quite as strong as they used to be? I don't know. It was an interesting point I thought that I hadn't considered before.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that brings us on excellently to the next part of the podcast. Next, I'll be speaking to Seb Stafford-Bloor about Mourinho and Spurs and looking ahead to that Champions League tie with RB Leipzig. Chris, thank you very much.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you're enjoying this episode, you'll love the new 442 on sale now. As well as an in-depth profile of Jose Mourinho, we have interviews with the likes of Andre Iniesta, Benjamin Mendy, Mateo Kovacic and Rio Ferdinand. Features on Sadio Mane, football's myths, the coup de France and Europe's biggest losers, as well as much, much more. Subscribe now to get 13 issues a year delivered straight to your door for less than £3.80 a mag. Just head to myfavouritemagazines.co.uk/FFTpod20 or follow the links in the notes below. So Seb, how do Tottenham fans feel about Jose Mourinho as manager at the moment?
I think it's mixed, Connor. I think there's a little bit of trepidation about what the future might hold, because essentially the club have appointed someone who is as ideologically detached from their own past as it was probably possible to find. You know, Jose Mourinho's success, at least in his sort of in his second act as manager, has depended on heavy spending and on kind of recruiting the sort of the off the peg players that Tottenham have typically shied away from, at least sort of the game's very best off the peg players. So at the moment, I think there's a little bit of intrigue and there's some novelty to it, because I think it's a there's something incongruous about seeing Jose Mourinho manage a Tottenham team, which is a little bit fascinating. But I think there's also, I think most fans would probably accept that there's a slight sense of dread that eventually there's going to be a fracture, potentially, because philosophically there is so much ground between him and ultimately Daniel Levy.
And because there is ultimately always a fracture wherever he goes, no matter how ideologically kind of aligned to that club.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the pattern. Now, I think between you and I, we've published a few things about Jose Mourinho. We did something the night he was appointed, yeah, and when Pochettino left. And there's this strange expectation that he should almost have a clean slate. Mm. And I understand that as a mentality. If you change job, you get a new reputation. We both know what that's like. But at the same time, when you have established a pattern of behavior over like a decade and a half, it's a little bit unrealistic not to expect people to be informed by that reputation, to think that, you know, come year three, the whole stadium is going to be ablaze and all kinds of fires are going to be set, you know, and it's going to be all sorts of chaos. I think that's, and I think that factors into a lot of people's thinking at the moment.
And so where do Spurs need to improve tactically at the moment? And are those kind of areas that, you know, you would possibly associate with Mourinho anyway?
I think the one that jumps out at the moment is the pressing at the top of the formation. Mm. In a strange way, the injury to Harry Kane has kind of helped that a little bit, because he's, on last Sunday's game against Manchester City, he started Lucas Morris, Son Heung-min and Steven Bergwijn. Mm. And those are, you know, three excellent, outstanding technical footballers, but they're also three excellent athletes as well. So there's a little bit more motion, there's a little bit more pressure on a team's defensive phases, on Man City's defensive phases. But they've been very passive. And it's very unnerving given the sort of the state that the defence is currently in, which is, you know, they're fragile. I think that's fair. Like there's work to do at both fullback positions. Toby Alderweireld has been stable, but I'd say that Davinson Sanchez has suffered a huge loss of form over the last year. Mm. So if you're playing passively with that kind of weakness at your heart, that's a problem. So I'd like to see them be a bit more aggressive without the ball. I think that's job A for him. I think
he's been in post a couple of months now. It actually feels a lot less than that. Yeah, I feel, but. Yeah. Are we starting to get a sense of a plan? Are we starting to understand what Jose Mourinho Tottenham will look like? Or is it still kind of, is it still very much just a Pochettino Tottenham that Mourinho is inexplicably managing?
It's a hard question to answer, Connor. What I'll say, it's not Pochettino team anymore. It's definitely not. I mean, right. The faces are familiar, but the nature of the mood of the way they play is so different that it's obviously not. I wouldn't describe it as being typically Mourinho-esque, because it's a little bit too charitable. It's not stingy. It has certain characteristics, like it can be negative and, you know, a bit cynical sometimes. And there are sensory sort of revelations occurring, you know, in the technical area, Mourinho cackling and enjoying other sides of his fortune. And you know, we were talking before we started recording about him celebrating Son Heung-min's goal by running 30 yards to give him some tactical instructions with 10 minutes left to go. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen anything yet, which I think this is going to be a pattern that's built on. I think it's a mood at the moment. Mm. I think what Tottenham are likely to be is going to start emerging in the summer when they move away from some of their kind of patchwork solutions. At the moment, there's a lot of like things like Jafet Tanganga playing fullback. Mm. Like he's probably a centre half. He's done ever so well, and he's a real, you know, he seems like a lovely guy as well. But he's a central defender or a right back at a stretch. So once these have gone, I think then Mourinho has a sort of license to approach things with a little bit more direction rather than just to kind of let's make the best of a bad situation.
Mm. We talked a little bit there about Spurs 2-0 win over City last weekend. Obviously it was against Pep Guardiola that brought in this whole other area of intrigue to it, but it also just felt like a classic Mourinho victory. I think Tottenham had two shots on target and scored two goals, and City I think had 24 attempts or something like that. But was it a tactical success for Jose?
No.
this feels like it's been a big part of the conversation. It's like, was this his plan all along?
But Connor, it's like this is like a reflex, Connor. It's like it's kind of anytime Mourinho wins a game of football, it's a tactical masterclass.
Yeah.
There is no other manager on the face of the earth who that applies to.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. It was Mourinho-ish in spirit because it depended on digging in and effort and concentration and the nature of it, the kind of the rope-a-dope aspect suited his reputation. On another day, City 3 up at halftime. And, you know, I actually on the sort of the day we were recording this, we did an article on like the differences between this Tottenham side and their little incidentals, which no one would notice unless they're missing. So how hard are players working to kind of retrieve what looks like a lost situation? How much effort are they trying to put into distracting a forward with a goal scoring opportunity? Now, if you look back at the detail of that Man City game, and particularly at some of the chances they lost, the chances they missed. So the Aguero miss in the first half, the Gundogan miss in the second, you're seeing things which shouldn't ordinarily happen to Man City, and the responsibility for that lies with them. But in each instance, you're also seeing like a hassling, harrowing tackle or a lunge. And a couple of weeks ago, these things weren't happening. And I think that's partly because there was so much baggage in the Tottenham team. There was a sense that because you had sort of, you know, Christian Eriksen there, Danny Rose there, you had players who weren't committed to the cause. So really, what was the point in kind of embracing this new era entirely until those players were gone? Because ultimately, they weren't committed and eventually they would let people down. So it's interesting. It's a little bit tenuous. And, you know, by the time this comes out, maybe that will look completely foolish and the article will be entirely redundant. But it's interesting. It's like, it's like trying to, you know, when two tennis players are having a rally, it's like, you know, one player's losing it, but he makes his opponent play one extra shot because there's a propensity that something might go wrong. Shouldn't, yeah. But if it does, then you kind of reward it for your effort. And I feel like that's what Tottenham were against Man City. And it was interesting.
So what do you think has been the best performance under Mourinho so far?
Oof. I don't think there's been a good performance. There are aspects of games I liked. The first half against West Ham, his first performance. The last 20 minutes against Liverpool.
I was going to say the Liverpool one does come up.
See, I think this is a really hard one to judge because is a team defending well if it just sits behind the ball and hopes for the best? I'd argue not, because that's okay if you're Newcastle or if you're Norwich. I think if you're Tottenham and you're signing £50 million players, I think that's a little bit too much to ask for fans to appreciate that. But I, you know, the comeback against Olympiacos was encouraging. I think the clean sheet against Watford was great, but I think we're still waiting for that 90-minute performance. Where they don't just ride their luck, where they're actually a protagonist within a game. We're still really waiting for that.
So the Champions League is back later this month. Tottenham have got RB Leipzig. Leipzig are having a great season. They're second in the Bundesliga. In fact, they've got Bayern Munich this weekend, so they could go top if they beat them. How big a challenge is this for Tottenham?
Massive. Also, you'd be hard pressed to find a team that Spurs were less well matched against.
Right. Okay.
Because I think particularly, like, you think of Leipzig, you think of Werner. You know, I know it doesn't begin and end with him, but Werner's pacey.
There's a lot there.
There's a lot there, but also, like, you think, right, what is the single attribute that defense struggles with at the moment? Pace. It's really difficult. Also being pressed, because Alderweireld remains a very classy centre half, but there are big question marks around him. And you know, there's Serge Aurier. If he doesn't give a penalty away at some point during those two legs, I'll be stunned. Yeah. We can have a follow up for this podcast. Just that can be an entire episode of itself. But also, you think, like, okay, so you know, we've spoken about Tanganga and how impressive he's been, but do you put a player who is that inexperienced and who hasn't faced that range of challenges into that kind of game? That's really difficult. And then you factor in players like Sabitzer, and it's tough. It's really, really hard. I'd say Leipzig are deservedly favourites.
I'll look forward to it. Seb, thank you very much.
Yeah, pleasure, Connor.
Thanks to Chris and Seb for joining me today. Don't forget the new issue, Jose versus the World, is on sale now. You can save money by subscribing to the mag at myfavouritemagazines.co.uk/FFTpod20. The music you've heard is by Hal Griff and is available on iTunes and Spotify, just like this podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.